thanks for giving us this interview today. And for all of you who may not know, Charles Daly is a very accomplished strength coach who is a competitive fighter for many years himself and trains many elite and Olympic-level athletes. He's been nice enough to answer some questions for me today. So, Charles, what type of training information should a trainee track?
Well, you know, that's really related to your goals. So, you know, obviously, if your goal is primarily body composition, then you're tracking skin folds and body weight and measurements and those sorts of things. On the other hand, if you have more performance-oriented objectives, by the way, it doesn't have to be strength. It can be endurance, flexibility. I mean, there's a lot of different biomotor abilities that are involved in training, although we're talking mostly about weight training. But, you know, if you're looking for measures of maximal strength, then you're testing your 1RMs and whatever the pertinent lifts are. If it's speed strength, you might be tracking your vertical jump, your 40-yard dash, things like that. So really, the things that you track are primarily related to your goal. And also, regardless of what your goal is, you need to track recovery. So in other words, things like your resting heart rate, your appetite, your willingness to train, things like that, things that really indicate how training is impacting your body.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that's very interesting about how training, your actual recovery, a lot of people don't think of training from that standpoint. They go for fatigue, as you've told me before. Now, these different indices that you track, whether it be sleep quality or appetite and stuff like that, I'm assuming they're directly related to anabolism or hormonal output, neurological output, that type of thing.
Yeah, hormonal and nervous system, both. And, you know, I sort of always make this joke, you know, it's been said that music isn't determined by the notes, but the spaces between the notes. So in the same way, training is only good if you can recover from it. And that's the thing that people tend to forget.
Mm-hmm. And would you tend to say that maybe people who are more genetically talented, like a professional athlete, for example, might have a better recovery ability than average person?
Yeah, but I don't see... It's in some ways unclear what it means to be genetically talented,
right?
So you can be, as a matter of fact, people who have high white fiber composition, for example, you can make an argument that they have poorer recovery ability, you know, so, you know, for a certain type of work. So I think there's truth in it, but to what degree that it really is useful is hard to say.
So after tracking this information, what can you do with it, with the actual numbers, and what should you look for when you're looking in your actual records?
Well, I'll give you an example. You know, obviously your waking pulse is an indicator of what kind of stress load your body is under, not just in terms of training, but just general overall health. So, you know, if my average pulse in the morning is 50 beats per minute, and one day I wake up and it's 62, you know, regardless of how enthusiastic I am about training or anything else, that's an indicator that for some reason the body is dealing with some type of stress. You might have just been introduced to a virus. You might be overtrained. I mean, it could be any number of things. But if I got that kind of an indicator in the morning, I would be really on the lookout, you know, in terms of other indices, in terms of whether or not to train that day.
So you might not train at all, or you might adjust your workout even, depending on what you
see. Yeah, even if a workout is scheduled, we might just insert another day off. I mean, I think training programs are kind of like, food recipes. If you have 100 people that make a meal out of one recipe, they're all a little bit different. So although you have a certain recipe, you need to make adjustments on the fly.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like people's individual recovery levels will vary widely across the board, just depending on what's going on in their life, huh?
From person to person and from day to day.
And that's something that people would do well to track with and kind of adjust their workouts accordingly.
I can't imagine not tracking it. Although most people don't track it, but I couldn't imagine. I mean, if you don't have some sense above and beyond just saying, well, I feel good today or I don't feel so good today, you need to have more quantitative measures. And the ones that I use, again, are body weight, your appetite, your waking pulse, mm-hmm. Your desire to train, mm-hmm. How your body feels in general in terms of soreness and things like that. So those are the ones that we track mm-hmm. most rigorously.
Mm-hmm. When making a 12-week training plan, which is a standard block of time that training would use to design something ahead of time, if you determine your goals, how do you get there? So when you're in essence designing a training plan, how do you make those goals happen? What kind of different things can you do? How can you improve?
Over the course of a cycle, training should go from general to specific. So if your goal, for instance, is to improve one rep max on a certain lift, say the squat, then the types of training that are most specific to that goal occur mostly toward the end of the cycle. And things that are less specific, exercises that might be designed to improve weak points and things would be more toward the beginning. And the other thing that you have to keep in mind is your ability to, track these things into the future. For example, I might have a goal that by August, well, it's already August, by October 1st I want to squat 365 pounds. But if I'm only squatting 300 pounds right now, then you have to say, well, that gives me approximately 8 weeks to go from 250 to 365, and that equals whatever, you know, whatever that number is per month. Basically, you're trying to gain 15 pounds per month, and that's not realistic. So it's important that you're able to project the numbers into the future. So you have a goal, but then you have to say, well, how much time do I have from now till there? And that's what determines what's realistic. So those are the two things that I think you have to think about.
I read in one of your articles that the three key or most obvious things that you see in person improving themselves is either by intensity, volume, or density. Can you expand on all of those for us?
Well, those are the three components of the training load. You know, volume is the amount of training you do. The intensity is the quality. And density is the work-rest ratio. So, you know, strangely enough, most exercise forms that are popular in this country today, for instance, if you look at Tai Bo, you know, you could be doing Tai Bo for years and still have the martial arts skill of a beginner on his first day of class at the worst school in town. So even though he's done more work than the average 10th degree black belt who's been studying for 25 years, and that's because Tai Bo, just as an example, uses extremely high volume at the expense of quality or intensity. So what usually happens at the beginning is that, you know, if you think back to your own lifting career, most people's 1RMs and their lifts go up and up and up, and every week you have a new personal best in your squat. And after 2, 3, 4 years, that starts slowing down. And so then you find that you're still able to do more sets and reps at any given percentage. So although it might be really hard now to get a new one rep max on your squat, you can still work toward doing more sets and reps maybe at 80%. So that's a system that emphasizes volume. People take that course on their own just instinctively. You know, when they can't get new 1RMs all the time, then they start working the volume approach. After another 3, 4, 5 years of that, which is where most people come to me and they're plateaued for a couple of years, what I find is that if you concentrate on training density, which means just doing more work in the same amount of time, or another way to look at it is the same amount of work in less time, that creates a new stimulus that gets people over plateaus. It's particularly effective for people who've been training a long time.
So what might you do? Would you mind like cut the rest period by like 10 or 15 seconds a
sure.
week or something like that?
Yeah, or even a little bit more. But you know, you do the same workout 4 weeks in a row, and you gradually whittle off you whittle time off of the rest periods. So, for example, I might do 5 sets of 8 in 20 minutes on week 1, and on week 2, I seek to do that same workload, same sets, same reps, and same weight in 18 minutes. Week 3, I try to do it in 16 minutes, and we go from there. Usually, what I do is I have people test on week 4.
Interesting. So, you could just basically, you give them, you know, anywhere from, I guess, the first week, 20 minutes to do that whole progression, 5 by 8, and they can just use the rest in between sets as needed.
Right. I don't usually use symmetrical rest periods because as you go set by set by set, your fatigue is accumulating. So really you need less rest at the beginning and more rest at the end. So if you tell someone, okay, do 5 sets in 20 minutes, then what they'll do instinctively is they'll try to get a head start. They'll try to be more than halfway through by the halfway point. And then they'll use, that gives them more rest toward the end when they really need it. So that's, I think, more efficient.
Intensity, by its very definition, is getting stronger, is using progressively heavier weights. What kind of strategies do you do for that? I mean, when you get to an advanced point, it's hard to add 5 pounds every week like you kind of mindset for? From an intensity standpoint, to keep those weights moving up, what kind of things can you do?
Well, for one thing, you know, we know that motor unit recruitment is based on how much tension a muscle is under. So there's two ways to put tension on a muscle. One is the amount of weight that you use, and the other is how fast you move that weight. So you can use the same weights and attempt to accelerate them faster. And so that way the same weight puts more tension on the muscles and you get a renewed training effect.
Interesting. So people who have been using progressively heavier weights and lifting in, I guess what you could say, a pretty traditional manner, if they just try accelerating the weight, it'll give them a new stimulus and they might be able to bust through a strength limit to plateau.
Right. People are always afraid to move weights fast, but in my mind, I mean, that's how, you know, if I ask you to move a 150-pound anvil from the floor to the top of your refrigerator, I don't think you're going to try to do that as slowly as possible. You're going to try to use momentum, and that's how the nervous system is wired. So I think that training should respect that fact.
Mm-hmm. And from a volume standpoint, which is, total work done, I see people adding sets and sets and sets, and over a certain amount of time, they'll be doing so much work per actual workout. I mean, when's enough enough? I like we discussed before, individual recovery rates vary, and people need to determine what they can recover from. But what's an easy way to determine when's enough enough, when there's diminished returns from doing more work?
Sure, and when that happens, generally I would assume that you're doing too much as opposed to that you're doing too little.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to take 100 trainees and pour them out into a pile, probably 80% are doing too much, and 5% are doing it just right, and 15% are doing too little,
mm-hmm.
would be my guess.
Mm-hmm.
So always assume that you're doing too much.
Mm-hmm. So you'd want to perhaps err on the side of caution, maybe do less than potentially more. I mean, you might err and do a little bit less, and you're unsure, but it's going to seem like a lot less, but that if you're in a situation where you're slightly overtrained, you might get diminished results, but if you're slightly undertrained, you can still make progress.
Sure. I mean, people always associate progress with how bad they're feeling, and but particularly the more talented you are, the more recovery you need because you're able to impact your system more strongly. So, I always say to people, if you want to feel bad, you can just run out in traffic. And that'll accomplish.
Yeah, that might do it.
And you don't have, save yourself the gym fees.
Mm-hmm. So when someone's building in weekly goals from like an intensity standpoint, should they just look at how long the period is going to go and how long they're going to use that exercise? And should they train week by week saying, I've got to get 5 pounds this week, I've got to get 5 pounds that week? Or should they look at like a longer period of time and say, 3 or 4 weeks, I'm going to get this weight?
You can go 5 pounds a week as long as your exercise menu changes every 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there should be continuity. So if you have some exercises that you do consistently all the time or for a 12-week period, you can't seek a 5-pound-a-week gain in 12 weeks because then you're going to put 60 pounds on your lift.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not, I would be looking for more in the order of 5 pounds a month rather than 5 pounds a week.
Right.
But if it's an exercise that you're doing for 4 weeks only and then you switch, then I would seek 5 pounds a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then the idea is that by the third week, you're going to have it really maxed right out. So then you're going to change anyway.
So then you're going to change exercises. So in essence, a way to get stronger is constantly changing those exercises. And then when it comes back to an exercise you've done and you hit a new weight the last phase, you go back to that weight again and try and break that record.
Right. So, for instance, if I do the good morning exercise in February for a period of 3 weeks, on the third week, I'm going to have a maximal number, basically, for whatever sets and reps I'm doing. So
mm-hmm.
then if later in the year, in August, I'm doing that exercise for another three-week phase, before you even do the first workout with that exercise, you should look back to February in your training log
mm-hmm.
and see what your numbers were, and obviously you're looking to improve upon that.
Mm-hmm. So how do people constantly improve over the long term from their training? I mean, for someone who even wants to get stronger, if they're doing an intensity type program, they're trying to add weight, but they just can't do it, should they look to perhaps volume or density to break through that plateau and then give intensity a rest for a while?
Well, the best program is the one you're not doing. So, and best exercise is the one you're not doing. Louis Simmons always says, somewhere out there there's an exercise that'll put 40 pounds on your bench press and all you have to do is find it. So
mm-hmm.
I agree with that. So I think what you really need to do is look at what you are doing now. If you have a long history of really doing heavy weights, low volume, then obviously that's a stimulus that your body has habituated to. And so the stimulus that is going to be novel for you is going to be taking a more volume-based approach,
mm-hmm.
or density.
Mm-hmm. How do you control experiments? For example, if I'm going to try a new training method and I want to see, does this thing get me bigger? Does this training method get me stronger? How do you have to control the experiments for factors and different stuff? Will a change in diet necessarily throw off all your results, or perhaps even a change in supplementation? What should you look for to see whether or not something worked?
It's easier to do with people who are more experienced because their training results are more stable. So, that's the first thing. And the second thing is, of course, you need to control for all extraneous variables as much as you can. So I certainly would not be making changes in diets and so forth. So, as many external variables that you can control for, the better off you're gonna be doing. So.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of a lot of the training programs out there that are specifically used for strength with these slow eccentric motions?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would assume they'll make you stronger eccentrically just by principle of specificity. The problem with, if you're utilizing the stretch shortening cycle in the movements that you're doing, which is that switch from eccentric to concentric, that switch has to be rapid if you're going to benefit from it. So, the trick really is to not lower a weight so quickly that you have to revert, that it creates so much force that you injure yourself, but not so slowly that you fatigue yourself. There's a perfect middle ground.
Mm-hmm. I see some lifters really use a powerbomb technique on the squat where they'll just drop like a rock and then shoot out of there.
Yeah.
And then I see other guys who, kind of methodically move pretty slow into that point and hit parallel and then blow up. Is that just an individual preference? Might there be something different in those people's training?
Sure. Some people have a better stretch shortening cycle than others. Or I should say a better ability to capitalize on it. And that could either be through what they normally do in training, or it could have something to do with the genetic makeup of their muscle fibers. But in any event, there's a middle ground with this as well. So, for example, if you look at a vertical jump, there's two ways to do a vertical jump. The one way is that you can take a big preparatory movement and a big arm swing and jump up. And the other way is to take a short little hiccup almost. The preparatory movement is very short. And so the first method gives you a longer movement path to accelerate out of, but it does not allow you to capitalize on the stretch shortening cycle.
Mm-hmm.
The second method is a smaller movement path, but you can better utilize the stretch shortening cycle. So if you go too far in either direction, it's not going to work. There's a perfect middle ground in terms of finding that balance between how much of a movement path you're moving over.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is if you take a big preparatory movement, then your joint angles become so steep that you have no leverage anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I don't know how clear that'll come out, but yeah.
So for someone who uses that powerbomb technique and they're trying to use some bigger weights, and every time they're using the same descent or the same eccentric speed, and they find they just can't get out of the hole anymore with these heavier weights, might they try to increase eccentric strength so they can lower those weights fast and maybe improve themselves?
No question. And what I was trying to say before that wasn't working is, if you look at how, for instance, research shows that powerlifting in the bench press exercise, most benchers do best when they lower slowly. And the reason probably for that is because when you lower a bar slow, the momentum is minimal, so there's less downward force that you have to reverse.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you lower a bar quickly, that develops a very large amount of tension in the muscles that can be returned concentrically through a stretch shortening cycle.
Right.
So you have to find the middle ground that works well. You lower a bar too quickly, the momentum becomes so huge that you just can't overcome it. If you go too slowly, you can fatigue yourself because of how much time you're under tension. So there's a perfect middle ground that you just have to find.
Mm-hmm. Is there a good way to test someone's eccentric strength, maybe, like in comparison with their concentric, and then maybe being able to tell something from that ratio?
Well, I mean, there is this concept of a strength deficit, which is the difference between your concentric level of strength and eccentric. The problem is, in order to test this, by definition, the eccentric test has to be done slowly, because if you just lower 500 pounds in a hundredth of a second, that doesn't prove anything except for the fact that you couldn't control the weight. So generally, if you're testing eccentric strength on a squat, you want to lower that bar maybe for 4 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you test concentric, if you're going to have any positive correlation, you need to also lower the bar for 4 seconds, which is maybe not what you always do.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, if you test a bench press, a standard bench press where you lower the bar and lift the weight, and you test a 1RM where the eccentric lasts 4 seconds, mm-hmm. and then you test the eccentric only where it lasts 4 seconds, you look at the difference between concentric and eccentric.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a big, big difference, what it basically means is that you're not using a high percentage of the motor units that you have. If there's very little difference between concentric and eccentric, it means that you're using a large percentage in terms of recruiting the muscle fibers you have. You're recruiting a very large percentage of them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're recruiting a large percentage of those motor units, then it means that your nervous system efficiency is good, and that probably the best thing to pursue is hypertrophy-based means.
Mm-hmm. So if your eccentric strength is a lot greater than your concentric strength,
your nervous system's not efficient.
Okay.
Because the eccentric basically tells you how much muscle you have, and the concentric shows you how much of it you're able to recruit. There's a big gap. It means you're not recruiting a large percentage of what you have. And so, therefore, nervous system-based training methods are what you want to rely on most.
It's pretty interesting. I've noticed in my own training that when I'll train for body composition, I can do a body composition test like every 3 weeks. You know, I have training protocols for body composition. But when I'm strength training, I might do a 3-week strength training program to improve my bench. But at the end of that 3-week period might not be the time I see the results.
No, you test the next week. So in the way I set up cycles, we do 4-week mesocycles where you progress from weeks 1, 2, and 3, and then on week 4 you test. Now, it seems like you're not getting a rest because week 3 is your hardest week, and then you test on week 4. But usually what I'll do is, for instance, if you on week 3, if you do your bench press-related work on a Monday, on week 4 you don't test on Monday. You would test maybe on Wednesday or Thursday so that you've got some more rest. You've got 3, 4, 5 days of rest in between. So
mm-hmm.
that's how I would do that.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, you work with a lot of elite and Olympic athletes. I mean, really top-notch people. But are you willing to deal with, someone maybe like myself who's not an elite athlete yet or trying to get to that point? Just, someone who's very interested in training and wanting to get help from an expert like you. And what kind of things can you usually resolve for these people?
Well, usually, first of all, I do work with non-athletes. Most of my people are athletes, but I work with non-athletes as well. As long as their goals are performance-related, I'm not terribly interested in body composition type things. But basically, it's important, even if you know what you're doing in terms of training, it's important to have an objective viewpoint. And I even run my own training by other experts in the field just to get a fresh perspective on what I'm doing. And a lot of times, you can find that you're making mistakes that are kind of obvious, but you don't see it because you're so close to what you're doing. So you need, having a fresh pair of eyes looking at what you're doing is what it takes to discover flaws.
Mm-hmm. So if someone does contact you that you're interested in working with, what do you do? Do you provide services to write them a program or something, or can people come see you for personal training?
Yeah, both. Can work either way. We can do a program for them at a distance over the internet. It's not the most ideal thing to do, but if somebody doesn't have direct physical access to me, that's an option. All of that's available through my website, and there are also people who come in and train with me for a week or for a day, so all sorts of options are possible.
Mm-hmm. And Charles's website is myodynamics.com, and that's MYODYNAMICS.com. He just had it redone. It looks really cool. He's got a lot of articles on there and all kinds of free information. Well, Charles, I really appreciate your time today, and I'm sure everyone who listens to this interview is going to benefit greatly from your expertise.
Ditto.